Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Best-selling novelist Mary Higgins Clark opens today's morning show in just a moment. A quick reminder that there is no morning show tomorrow because of the 4th of July holiday weekend, but the morning show will return as always on Monday, and you can always find past morning show programs on the morning show archive on WGTD's website, wgtd.org. Click on Talk. Lane Harmon. What a delight for me to reconnect with one of the most successful authors in all the world, Mary Higgins Clark. Actually, I was just noticing her complete name, Mary Teresa Eleanor Higgins Clark Cuhini. What a great name.
Oh, God, did you get that?
Yeah, right. But it that would be a little crowded on the cover of a book. So, of course, most of the world knows you as Mary Higgins Clark. And, of course, more than 50 novels to your credit, and every single one of them a bestseller. And your latest book, which has just been published, is called The Melody Lingers On. Of course, quoting a great song from the Great American Songbook. And it is a very, very intriguing novel. You've done it once again, and I'm excited to be able to speak with you about your latest book published by Simon & Schuster. Mary Higgins Clark, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Oh, thank you so much, Greg. It's lovely to be back with you.
You are not letting up on the gas pedal at all, are you? I have a feeling that writing for you is a bit like oxygen is for most other people. I mean, you just can't imagine life without it, I suppose.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head, because people say, you know, when are you going to retire and give yourself some free time? I don't want to retire. There's always something going on in my head. And what would I do if I retired? Well, what should I do? Well, I don't have a hobby like planting flowers or baking cookies. God knows I fed five kids for all those years growing up, but three meals a day. But at this point in my life, if I put a biscuit in the oven, it burns.
Well, you know how to put a book in the oven, that's for sure. You have this just down to a science. Ahead of us talking specifically about your latest book again called The Melody Lingers On, I wanted to ask you about something really intriguing that I read somewhere. I don't remember now where I came across this little tidbit of information from your early life, but I read that as a young adult, you had a part-time job for a while as a switchboard operator in a hotel.
And very young adult. I was 15.
Oh, my gosh. Tell our listeners about that, because the way this story was relayed to me, it essentially conveyed the notion that you probably did a little listening in, as was typical with operators back then. And I wonder to what extent that maybe fueled your imagination for some of these wonderful books you've written since.
A good example is Maggie Ryan. She was the lady of the house and the Shelton Hotel all those years ago. And I loved her phone calls. Well, she made appointments with men. And one time, because there's a way of, when a conversation is going on, if you're not busy, if you pull the plug out a little, you can eavesdrop without them knowing it. But one time she said to the guy she was making a date with, "Don't say another word. That damn operator is listening in." And I said, "I am not." And I immediately disconnected the call. And a minute later, the chief operator, "Who was listening in on Maggie Ryan?" "Not me, Lord." But what was the story when I sold Where Are the Children? Tennessee Williams lived in the Elysee Hotel, and I was writing radio shows at that time. And we would stop in for a glass of wine, the guys in the office, and then I would always get to my quarter of six carpool. I never missed it because, you know, I had children home. But he would be sitting at the end of the bar. And when I sold the book, but it hadn't been published yet, the bartender said, Mary, why don't I give Tennessee Williams a copy of the manuscript? Maybe he'd give you a plug. And I said, sure. So 2 weeks later, he handed me the book, the manuscript back, and he said, Tennessee said, I have a lot of friends who could write better than that.
Oh, dear. So much for the plug.
So much for the plug. Mm. But apparently a few people liked the book, even if Tennessee didn't.
Right, to say the least. I'm glad you mentioned, although just in passing, the fact that one of your other early jobs was writing for radio. And I want to just, if you don't mind, ask you briefly about that, because you were doing a kind of writing that really, for all intents and purposes, doesn't even exist anymore. But it sounds so fascinating. You were writing very, very short radio programs, from my understanding. Tell us about that project, and also what significance you think it might have had in shaping the best-selling author, which you ultimately were to become. Was that any kind of an important stepping stone?
Sure. These were four-minute radio programs, 5 a week in a station like yours, and they would say, and now today our visit from Hugh Downs, and now today. And it was food, it was travel, it was, the first show I started was called Portrait of a Patriot, and it started like this. At age 14, she was given the family tree and said, but I am nearer to the throne than I realized. Do you know who she is? And this is Hugh Downs for Portrait of a Patriot, furnished by Nestle's, makers of Taster's Choice. You only could give a plug. You couldn't give a long commercial. And then our patriot today was born in England. Halfway through, have you guessed who she is yet? No. Well, here are more clues. And at the very end, our patriot today, Victoria Regina, Queen of England, Empress of India, and all her properties on and on. Tune in tomorrow. So every day I had a different patriot. And I wrote three of those shows at a time, three of those series, a food show with Betsy Palmer, a news show with Bess Meyerson, Hugh Downs, Bill Cullen. These were the people who did the shows. And they could narrate 2 weeks at a time in one sitting. And for me, it was $20 a script. So it was $300 a week for three shows. And that was that's what I supported my kids on after I was widowed.
Right. Yeah. Upon the death of your beloved husband, Warren Clark, you really had to become the breadwinner of your family. And I know that it was amidst various frustrations that you actually took up writing in a really concerted fashion, but writing in longer forms. And of course, that's really where you hit your stride, and you've never looked back. I mean, it's been an extraordinarily successful career, and one I imagine you never could have imagined.
I've been blessed with it because I know so many people who are excellent writers. They get marvelous reviews, and they don't sell books. And that is so frustrating. There was someone who died just the other day, and they said one of the best writers in the country, I forget his name, but he never sold. He was underrated by the public. He might sell 800 books. Well, that's pretty darn disappointing when you've given a couple of years of your life to that project. So I've always been very grateful for the fact that I hit a note in the reading public, and I have not lost it all those years.
Mm, it's true. And it's intriguing that those little four-minute radio scripts that you would write, where you were letting out a little bit of information and a little bit of information, a little bit at a time, in a sense, sowed the seed for these wonderful suspense novels, which you have been writing ever since, and which, in a sense, on a much larger canvas, You do the very same thing.
As you know, radio is timed. If you're having an interview, it's this many minutes, not an extra minute. And so I had to time. I used to read my manuscripts in a cadence that maybe Hugh Downs was doing one, or Arthur Kennedy. I knew whether they spoke a little quickly, a little slowly, more emphasis. And that helped me wonderfully with writing, because I couldn't write, "She wandered slowly through the room." It would be, "She went." So I had to do tighter writing, which of course is very helpful in suspense.
Hmm. So you end up really thinking about each and every word and about every little snippet of information which is shared. And, of course, that has to happen in a novel as well. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with the great Mary Higgins Clark about her latest novel, which is called The Melody Lingers On. One of the things you've chosen to do here is to make your central character, Lane Harmon, and she's not a cop or a private investigator or anything of the sort. She is an interior designer, or she works for an interior design firm.
She is one herself, and her boss is a famous interior designer, famous and caustic, and takes no nonsense from her clients. And she sends Lane up. An investor has disappeared with $5 billion of his client's money. And their lives are shattered, because he always went after the little guy. He had his secretary write and congratulate people on their 40th wedding anniversary and say, "I would like to help you have a happier retirement when the time comes." And he suckers them all in. And then, of course, the money is going in his pocket, not theirs. And I thought it's an interesting premise. But then Lane goes to the house that they had decorated for his wife, and the feds have taken, they have clawed back everything in the house that was worth taking. So they wanted to elect for the wife of the guy. She's getting a modest townhouse. They select the furniture, but Lane starts to fall in love with the guy's son, a charming, attractive, who emphatically has sworn he is not guilty. He had no idea what his father was doing, nor did his mother. And the point is, did they know something? And as Lane starts to date him, she's getting involved in a serious more than worrisome, because there is someone out there going to kill the wife and mother in revenge for what the losing their funds did to his wife. He's deranged, and he said he's spending my money on her. So Lane is in deep trouble, and they are also decorating, she and the chief decorator, the home of this guy's mistress. And was she in on the plot? And where is the money coming to spend $5 million on to decorate an apartment? So I think it's a good mix of characters. I really do.
I really do, too. One of the things I especially like about it is that the principal character, Lane Harmon, finds herself kind of caught up in a world that she does not begin to understand. I mean, it's one thing when you take an experienced FBI agent and you plunk him or her into the middle of this swirling intrigue. But an interior designer, I mean, she doesn't know anything about such going.
She only knows that she feels very sorry. The wife said, "I don't know whether he's dead. His sailboat had crashed in the Caribbean, and many people thought he had committed suicide because he knew that the feds were going to be after him. They had gotten on to the scheme. So did he commit suicide? Was she in on the plot? Was her son in on the plot?" The son even hires an independent agency to say, "I want you to investigate. I want you to turn every stone. I want to try to prove my innocence. I know some people won't believe me, but the integrity of your firm, if you are able to come out and say there is absolutely no evidence that Eric is part of this scheme." So Lane doesn't know who to believe, the feds or Eric, and his absolute denial, and no one can trace him to it. And then there was somebody planning to kill the wife and the mother and now Lane. So I think it's a good mix of characters. I love them.
Yeah, I really do, too. Another thing I really appreciate about the novel is that, along with all of the suspense, you really help us feel the authentic pain of many of these characters. Lane herself is a widow, and you write so potently about that. And, of course, as someone who's tasted that sorrow yourself, I guess it's no surprise that you should be able to share that so richly. And then we also get to know some of these characters whose lives have really been ruined by what Parker Bennett has done, including his own wife, Anne. And we get a sense of the dignity with which she's trying to carry on in the face of such disgrace. I appreciate the fact that you really took some time in your novel.
Oh, you want to. If you say this woman is or seems to be bewildered, and she goes into the hairdresser. Well, this happened with Murdoch. His wife went into the hairdresser. She'd always gone, and the guy wouldn't let her stay. He said, too many of my clients have lost their money and are furious. And she had to walk out of her hairdresser. And I use that in this book, but nothing else about the Madoffs. It is not about the Madoffs. It is about the people who have been cheated and whose lives are wrecked. There's even a support group for them in the book. And one couple said, we had to move in with my son and daughter-in-law, and we always got along so well. But now we know they resent us. We're both hard of hearing, and we turn the television on too loud. They go out rather than sit and listen to it.
Hmm.
And we can't do anything about it. I mean, think of yourself in that kind of circumstance.
Hmm. You really help us put ourselves in that position. A last quick question. Tell us about June Crabtree, to whom the book is dedicated.
Oh, dear. June was when we went to Villa Maria Academy together from age 13 to 17, and we had gotten away from each other. Then we both went to Main Chan Spa in Arizona, and the minute she had dark glasses on and a big straw hat, but the minute I heard her voice, I said, I missed your name. She said, June Crabtree. I said, was it ever June Lundgren? And we're sitting in our matching bathing suits and little pink robes. And I said, June, must we always meet in uniform? And one of her very elegant friends said, and where was Villa Maria Academy? I said, on Long Island Sound. And June grabbed me later, and she said, Mary, thank God you didn't say the Bronx. Yes, it was on Long Island Sound, but in the Bronx. And I said, June, if you thought this, the sacred name of the Bronx was going to be thrown around in this joint, forget it.
Hmm.
So we've connected, and we have been close friends all these years, and very close friends. And she died in, I think it was in November that June died. And then another one of our Villa Maria pals just died last month. It's, you know, at my age, I'm 87 and a half. And of course it happens to people this age, but it doesn't make it any easier. So I was so glad to dedicate the book to June.
Hmm. The book, again, is The Melody Lingers On, published by Simon & Schuster. Mary Higgins Clark, congratulations on yet another fine book, and very best wishes to you.
Oh, thank you so much. A joy to be with you again.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. The time is 8:30. This portion of The Morning Show is spent tracing the history of a drink, specifically the Old Fashioned, one of the great classic drinks, and a drink which has an intriguing and varied history and its fortune, so to speak, of sort of ebbed and waned and flowed and surged and undergone intriguing changes over the years. And much of that has been traced by author Robert Simonson in a fascinating new book called The Old Fashioned, The Story of the World's First Classic Cocktail with Recipes and Lore. Robert Simonson has written for Wine Spectator, Wine Enthusiast, Imbibe, Edible, well, you get the idea, and a number of other journals, the food blog Eater, and he is responsible for this lovely book, complete with beautiful photographs and a number of recipes as well, in which one can find all kinds of different ways to create an old-fashioned yourself. And I'm really glad we can have Robert Simonson with us for the next few minutes to talk about his book, which is published by 10 Speed Press. Robert Simonson, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thanks.
I'm not much of a drinker, so I certainly am not a connoisseur of alcoholic literature, so to speak, or literature about alcohol, let's call it. But I'm just wondering, are there a lot of books like this out there tracing the history of a particular drink with this kind of careful eye for detail, or is this a unique or at least quite uncommon sort of book?
Yeah, I'd say it's an uncommon sort of book. You're right. There aren't many books out there. The one drink that has gotten the book-length treatment and gotten it repeatedly has been the martini over the years. There must have been a dozen books just about the martini over the decades. I just thought it was time that the old-fashioned had a book of its own. It's a drink that's older than the martini. It dates back 200 years, almost to the dawn of the Republic. And it is one of those classic drinks that kind of is high up there on the whatever the cocktail Olympus, along with the Manhattan and the martini and the daiquiri. And it is also a drink that is enjoying a significant comeback right now. So it seems like the time was ripe.
You point out that it is shown with the great flourish on one of the most popular programs to be viewed on television in recent years, Mad Men, which
yeah.
Probably either helped signal or has helped contribute to its resurgence, especially for the sake of any of our listeners who aren't directly acquainted with that show, I mean, who haven't actually watched it. Tell them how the old-fashioned figures pretty prominently.
Mad Men, it takes place in the 1960s. The series began in the early 60s, and it follows the history and travails of a Madison Avenue ad man named Don Draper. And Don Draper's drink of choice is the old-fashioned. In fact, in the very first episode of the very first season, before we even know his name, we know what his drink is, because his first line is asking for an old-fashioned. And you're right, it's a very popular series. It's been written about, and the fact that he drinks old-fashions and the fact that they drink cocktails in general has helped lift the profile of this drink. It's not been responsible for the revival of the drink. That responsibility can be laid at the feet of, you know, bartenders and mixologists who have, you know, taken their craft more seriously in recent years and revived a lot of these old cocktails. But Mad Men certainly hasn't hurt the popularity of the old-fashioned, not in the least.
Hmm. In the preface of the book, we learn about the importance of the old-fashioned to someone who's, to you, I'm sure, a lot more important than Don Draper, namely your mother. And I really appreciate the affection with which you write this preface as you talk about your mom. And in particular, the really sort of careful, thoughtful way in which she made her choices about what and when to drink particular mm-hmm. cocktails. Tell our listeners a little more about her and especially how she came to really appreciate and prefer the old-fashioned.
Certainly. Well, it occurred to me as I was researching the book, you know, that the old-fashioned, I mean, it became a favorite drink of mine and an interest of mine, but it was probably also the first cocktail I ever heard of by name, because it was my mother's drink. And at cocktail hour, every day at 5, my mother would have an old-fashioned. And so as I was wrapping up my research, I thought, you know, I mean, I should interview her and ask her why she chose that drink and why she likes it so much. And so I did. We sat down at the kitchen table in her house in Waukesha one day, and I interviewed her. I think she was a little nonplussed as to why she should be interviewed about such a thing. But I was quite surprised and quite pleased by the thoughtfulness of her answer. It had never occurred to me that she had put such a great deal of thought into her choice of drink. But, of course, that was like a different time, a different culture. In the 1950s, you know, drinking was part of social life. You went over to your friend's house and everybody drank, and everyone had their own particular drink. So she told me how she had gone through a series of trials and errors, and she had passed on the martini. It was too strong. She passed on the Manhattan because she thought the vermouth gave her headaches. And she finally settled on the old-fashioned, mainly because you can kind of control the drink. You can, like, tell the bartender how strong or how weak you want it, how much fruit, how little fruit. And also, it's a sipping drink. You can spend a long time over this drink. You can spend an hour over an old-fashioned. You can't do that with a martini because it gets warm very quickly. You basically have to drink it. But that's not true with the old-fashioned. So when she gave me that very reasoned and interesting answer, I just thought, well, that's the introduction to my book.
It's perfect. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Robert Simonson out about his book, The Old Fashioned, The Story of the World's First Classic Cocktail with Recipes and Lore. When it comes to trying to trace the history of a drink like The Old Fashioned, I think a lot of us, again, not quite so well acquainted with this whole world, would sort of pass that off as not too big a deal, not too big a challenge. And I think the more you think about it, the more you realize, yeah, how do you do that? How do you sort of sort out the history, and especially how do you trace it back towards at least close to its very beginning? Not just for the old-fashioned, but if we were to sit down and try to trace the history of any classic drink, what are the kinds of things you look for? What places do you go? What resources do you sift through to find the history of a drink?
Well, you're absolutely right. It's a tricky business. Because I write about cocktails and spirits for a living, I take them very seriously. I think it's a contribution that America has made to the world, you know, along with things like jazz and the musical theater. It is something we invented. We invented the cocktail. But obviously, you know, when people are drinking cocktails or inventing cocktails, they're in bars. And any history that's written in bars is a little shaky. So there's a lot of, there tend to be, people tend to tell tall tales and yarns and half-truths in bars. And the great historians of the 19th century weren't thinking, you know, the life of a bar room is the history I should be tracing. So what you have to do is, well, you first of all, you go through old cocktail books. They started being published in the 1860s, and you see what drinks are in there and the recipes and that are there. Usually the author is a bartender, and he has a lengthy introduction, which is usually his philosophy running a bar and creating drinks. You go to the archives of old newspapers. Certain newspapers are sort of interested in this sort of thing, and every now and then they have a feature story about a popular bartender or a new drink that's taken the town by storm. You look at old menus. And another thing you do is you read novels of the time, because usually there's a scene, often there's a scene in a bar, and you get a picture of how people drank and what they drank at a particular time.
Hmm. One of the chapters of your book is called First the Whiskey Cocktail, and this would be seem to be sort of a predecessor to the old-fashioned, or maybe even the first version of the old-fashioned. How do we place the whiskey cocktail in this history of the old-fashioned?
The thing to you have to keep in mind when you're thinking about the history of this drink is the full name of the drink. We all just call it the old-fashioned because that's what we're used to. It's shorthand. But the full name is old-fashioned whiskey cocktail. That's what it used to be called. And so that means that it was originally just the whiskey cocktail. That's what people called it for much of the 19th century. And a whiskey cocktail was simply whiskey with a little water, a little bitters, and a little sugar, and maybe a twist. There came to be a point in the 1870s where bartenders were starting to get a little fancy. They had new products on their shelves from Europe, things like Curacao and absinthe and various liqueurs. And they started trying them out in the cocktails. And this caused the old codgers and the people who like their drink just so to start asking for an old-fashioned whiskey cocktail so that the bartender knew exactly what they wanted. They didn't want any of this newfangled stuff. They just wanted the basic whiskey cocktail. But, yeah, that's where the drink started, as the whiskey cocktail.
There are all kinds of terms in your book that I don't know or didn't know at all until I picked up your book. One of the first that came up was when you talk about the whiskey cocktail being a drink that was primarily drunk in the morning. What is this interesting term that refers
matutinal.
To that?
Yeah, matutinal. It basically means morning, a morning thing. Yeah, drinking habits were different back then. The saloons opened early, and it was not unknown for a gentleman to pay a visit to the saloon before he went on to work. Those kind of drinks were called eye-openers. You know, they just got you ready for the day. You have to remember that back then, certain spirits and certainly bitters, which were often found in cocktails, were thought to be restorative and medicinal and to actually make you healthier. And this was also a time when you didn't necessarily trust the water source. So choosing to drink spirits or beer was thought by many to be a healthier choice.
Hmm. The chapter I especially enjoyed in your book is called The Rebellion, and it opens with this sentence. The history of the cocktail is one of advancement and correction, fashion and backlash. And this refers to something you've already touched on in the interview, namely that the old-fashioned, as it was known in its sort of purest, simplest, most straightforward sense, became a drink that got increasingly complicated by other additions to it. What was behind that, behind people sort of fussing with the whiskey cocktail and adding all of these things to it? Was it just what you mentioned, the fact that these other things were now available and just too tempting not to use?
Well, that was part of it. Between the Civil War and Prohibition, there was a real golden age of the cocktail. Back then, the bartender was a really respected and venerated figure in the community. It wasn't what it became after World War II, just kind of a workaday job, a dead-end job for people who didn't have an extensive education. Everybody looked up to the bartender and was interested in what he was doing. And the bartender took pride in his work. He really cared about, you know, whether his drinks tasted good. And he took pride in the idea that he could invent new drinks that became popular. So it's understandable that he would get excited, you know, when suddenly there's a new product. I mean, this still happens today. A new product is suddenly on the market, and bartenders want to see, you know, what can I do with this? So, you know, absinthe was a, you know, a good example. It came over, you know, it was very popular in France and Switzerland and thereabouts. And it came over to these shores, and then the bartender started thinking, well, what would this taste like if I put it in this drink? And that's what they did. Bartenders, when they're at the height of their skills, are always very curious and inventive people, I have found.
Two nuts and bolts matters with the old-fashioned are worth talking about, I think. One of them is the kind of ice, or the shape of the ice, or whether or not there's ice at all in the drink. That's been sort of different here and there, but there is a way in which, in the purest sense, you put ice into an old-fashioned. Describe to your listeners what I'm talking about.
Well, in the beginning, when it was just the whiskey cocktail, that drink was served without ice. You stirred it over ice, but then you strained it into a glass with no ice. Somewhere around the 1880s, 1890s, the old-fashioned started being served the way that we know it today, fixed in, served in the same glass in which it is prepared and served on ice. We're not quite sure why that change happened. It may have been that, you know, ice was fashionable. You have to remember that ice was like a sought-after commodity. It wasn't an everyday thing. And it may have been the drinking habits changed. In the early 19th century, drinks weren't very long for the world. They were drunk quickly. But toward the end of the 19th century, we were in the Gilded Age, and there were these beautiful grand cafes that people drank in, and people drank in a more leisurely fashion. So that's how the role of ice changed over the years.
How about this matter of the spoon? This is especially fascinating. Tell our listeners why a spoon has sometimes been an essential element or implement when it comes to serving up an old-fashioned.
Yes, that was one of my favorite discoveries in researching the book. As I looked through old cocktail books in the late 1800s, early 1900s, whenever there was a recipe for the old-fashioned, the last line of the instructions was always served with spoon in glass. And as far as I can tell, the spoon served the purpose of, like, the drinker being able to stir up the drink a little more and help the sugar dissolve a little more, because the drink was always made with a sugar cube that was muddled with water. And so there was a little bit of, you know, that granular stuff at the bottom of the glass. And so you could stir it up, and also when the drink was done, if you chose to, you could take the spoon and scoop up the remaining sugar, which tasted wonderfully of whiskey and bitters, and just put it into your mouth like a little bit of dessert at the end of the glass. But invariably, this is how the drink was made. This quaint little tradition got forgotten during Prohibition, and after Prohibition, nobody put a spoon in the glass anymore.
You just mentioned Prohibition, and of course, if you're going to trace the history of and the story of any alcoholic beverage that's been around for a while, the matter of Prohibition has to figure in there somehow. What is the effect of the Prohibition years on the old-fashioned, as near as you could ascertain?
As I mentioned in the book, Prohibition didn't do favors to any drinks. One of the effects of Prohibition is that bartenders were out of a job. So they either, you know, gave up, they found a new profession, or they went to Europe or Cuba or other places to practice their profession. So Prohibition lasted 13 years. After that, you know, when the bars reopened, there were very few people who knew or remembered how to do the job well. I mean, the young people didn't know anything, and there weren't many older people to teach them. So you get to the end of Prohibition, and you have to basically learn all over again, you know, how to make the drinks. And the effect of that had a strange one. It was a strange effect on the old-fashioned, because basically the old-fashioned changed completely. It was still a whiskey drink, but whereas before Prohibition, it had almost never had fruit, or if it had fruit, it had it as a garnish. After Prohibition, old fashions were always served with fruit, and often the fruit was muddled, you know, smashed up at the bottom of the glass. Mm. So it turned into a kind of a sort of a fruit punch. and that's basically how we still know it, most of us today. If you go to most bars and you order an old fashioned, you don't specify, that's how it will be served.
You also devote a chapter to the fact that your mother was not the only woman to be especially fond of the old-fashioned, that this became the drink of choice for many women in the post-Prohibition era. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, that's true. That was an interesting discovery. When Prohibition ended, all the newspapers sent out their reporters to, like, find out, you know, what was going on in the bars, how were they coping with the change, and what were they serving, and who was drinking it. And what they found was that the old-fashioned was still popular, very popular, but they also found out that it was very popular among women. One of the changes, probably, well, I'd say one of the good changes that was wrought by Prohibition was that women could now drink in public. In the speakeasies in the 20s, women and men sat side by side, and, you know, that hadn't been the case before Prohibition. It was not thought to be ladylike to be in a bar. But after Prohibition, women felt they could go into bars and freely order drinks, and what they ordered was sweet drinks, old-fashioned mainly. And I think they played a role in the drink coming back, you know, coming back with a vengeance. Mm.
You are speaking to someone at an NPR affiliate that's right in the southern corner of Wisconsin. So Illinois is just across the border. And I think a lot of our listeners would be especially interested in your book, because there's a whole chapter that talks about kind of a variant on the old-fashioned preferred here in Wisconsin. And mm-hmm. and the city of Chicago also yeah. figures pretty prominently in the history of the old-fashioned. Tell us about both of those strains of the story.
Well, as far as Chicago is concerned, the first appearance of the old-fashioned in a cocktail book was in a book published by a Chicago bartender named Theodore Prue in 1888, and he worked at a famous Chicago bar called Chapin and Gore. And there's also, I mean, we'll never know exactly, you know, where the old-fashioned started or where it became popular. That kind of history is lost forever. But there are good indications that it was an extremely popular drink all the years up until Prohibition in Chicago. Makes a lot of sense. You know, Chicago is very near Kentucky. They had a ready access to a lot of bourbon. And also, you know, Chicago is a, you know, a broad-shouldered town, and of course, you know, the men are going to drink strong spirits. So that's the Chicago connection. As far as Wisconsin, well, you know, the brandy old-fashioned is basically Wisconsin's state drink, and it has been as far as I can remember. So I think of Wisconsin as one of the incubators, one of the places in the nation that kept the old-fashioned alive as a cocktail in like the 80s and 90s, when the rest of the nation had almost forgotten about it.
Hmm. In our closing minute or two, say a word about this intriguing portion of the book in which you serve up a whole bunch of different recipes for the old-fashioned, starting with, of course, the classic drink in fairly pure form, but then some really intriguing variations on it as well. And amongst them, do you have a favorite or two?
Sure. Of course, strictly speaking, there's the old-fashioned is one recipe. You know, it's the whiskey old-fashioned that we all know. And you can have it with fruit or you cannot have it with fruit. That's your choice. But the thing about the recipe for the old-fashioned is it's highly adaptable. It's so simple, you know, just spirit, sugar, water, bitters, that you can apply it to almost anything. You can change the spirit, you can change the bitters, you can change the sweetener, you can change all three. It's still recognizably in structure and old-fashioned, and yet it's a new drink. A lot of bartenders and mixologists have been inventing their own versions of the old-fashioned in recent years, the past 5 or 6 years, and I include quite a few of those. One I like in particular is called the Awaka Old-Fashioned, which in which you use tequila and mezcal instead of whiskey. It's a very simple drink, but it's delicious. There's another one in there that it was invented by a Chicago bartender named Mike Ryan called the Clint Eastwood, and it involves a little bit of chartreuse as a sweetener, and I like that one very much too.
I am actually not much of a drinker, but when I feel like having something relatively strong, pretty strong for me, I order a Southern Comfort Old Fashioned Sweet.
Oh, there you go.
Now, is that just for someone like you? Is that just pure fruit punch, or is that a perfectly respectable version of the Old Fashioned?
Oh, everything's respectable if you like it. It sounds a bit on the sweet side.
Right.
I'm not sure. Do you add a little sugar as well as the Southern Comfort, or does the Southern Comfort provide the sugar?
I think the Southern Comfort provides the sugar, yeah.
Well, that might be fine. I actually know other people who enjoy that drink. But the thing about the Old Fashioned is that I think it has a reputation as a strong drink. But as I said before, it's a sipping drink, so it's a strong drink you can drink over a long period of time. So, in a way, it's both strong and mild to a certain manner of thinking.
Hmm. Well, it's an intriguing history, and you've done a great job of tracing it. And listeners who are intrigued to know more should take your beautiful book in hand. Again, it's called The Old Fashioned, The Story of the World's First Classic Cocktail with Recipes and Lore. It's published by 10 Speed Press, and a very pretty book full of full-color photographs. And the author, Robert Simonson. Robert Simonson, I've enjoyed your book and this chat. Thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
We want to remind you that there is no morning show tomorrow because of the 4th of July holiday weekend. On Monday, we're going to be speaking with a young man from Kenosha who has just competed in a national skills competition in Indianapolis and finished 10th in the nation in the category of prepared speech. On Tuesday, I'll speak with the author of Console Wars, which looks back at the fierce battle waged between two video game companies, Nintendo and Sega, back in the early 1990s. Next Wednesday, we'll preview for you the upcoming Secret Garden Walk here in Kenosha. Next Thursday will be the monthly visit of the United Environmental Council. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Again, not tomorrow, but normally. And you can find the archive on our website, WGTD.org, and click on Talk. Support for WGTD's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. A sunny, mild day today with a high of 70 degrees, clear overnight and cool, a low of 53. Sunny tomorrow as we warm to 79 degrees. Similar conditions on Saturday the 4th. Sunny with a high of 78 degrees. Sunday, sunny with a high of 80. The first significant chance of rain in our forecast.